Hi everyone, today's episode is a layup to our next episode about Hylai, and there's a little bit about Raymond Patriarca in this one too, so it's not entirely out of our wheelhouse.
And I know you had a great time going down rabbit hole after rabbit hole researching this one.
I did. There were so many bizarre connections. But before we get started, let's talk about our listeners' comments about Frankie Salemi being made. The consensus is that according to FBI reports, he was made when he was released in 1989 from prison.
I just wish the informant was identified. You know how I feel about what the feds had to say, especially at that time, because we know they were building a narrative.
Yeah, well, you know the informant was most likely Stevie Fleming.
Probably, and I think I promised David I would answer an older question this week.
I swear you smashed your head, not your knee.
Look, my head has been gone for a long time. As for the knee, I'm almost as good as new.
Well, glad you said it, not me. Now, back to David's question. He asked about Mark, Ralph, and Stephen Rossetti's alliance with Mello Merlino and Frankie Salemi.
Many of our listeners know that Stephen Rossetti was arrested and convicted with Mello for the planned Loomis Fargo armored truck holdup in 1999. Mello was aligned with Salemi. Mark and Salemi were also allies. They were both sued for $60 million by Michael Romano Jr.'s family for his murder while the duo were trying to seize power in 94. Mind you, this was while Mark was acting as an FBI informant.
Hey, I thought we weren't going to talk about you-know-who.
We aren't. I was answering a question.
Okay. David had one more question about Georgie Pappas, but David, since we want you to keep listening, you will have to wait for the next episode to hear our answer.
Okay, Nina, tell us about Rico's return.
I just want to briefly recap here. In 1969, with Richie's help, Special Agent H. Paul Rico got a transfer to the sunny beaches of Miami. We recounted that story in a previous episode, so make sure to go back and check that out if you haven't already. The link will be in the show notes. Rico completed his 24-year FBI career in Miami and retired on May 27, 1975. On June 8th that same year, the Miami Herald reported that he had been named a VP and Director of Security for World Hylai. Our next episode will be all things Hylai related.
Since you love the 70s so much, let's back up a little bit to the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa in July of 1975, which sparked a nationwide investigation into the Teamsters' pension funds around the country, mostly focusing on the ones in the Midwest. Later that year, the Department of Justice and the postal inspectors started investigating the trucking employees of the Passaic and Bergen County pension funds in New Jersey. Anthony, Tony Pro Provenzano, Salvatore Berguglio, the two Romano brothers, Frank and Thomas, and their cousin Tony Roma, the rib guy, were the focus of the investigation.
Hey, when I saw that it was Tony Roma of the Tony Romas, I was howling.
I'm
As
sure.
For Provenzano, he was allegedly one of the last people who had seen Hoffa alive. In March of 78, Berguglio was gunned down in New York City. He was shot 5 times in the head and once in the shoulder in front of Benito's II restaurant on Mulberry Street in Little Italy. His murder has never been solved.
Later that same month, Provenzano was convicted for another scheme involving union money for kickbacks. He and his co-defendant, Anthony Bentrovato, were found guilty on a single-count indictment that charged them with conspiring to offer a union trustee part of nearly $300,000 kickback that they were to receive for facilitating the $2.3 million mortgage. Then in June, Tony Pro was found guilty of ordering the 1961 murder of rival Tony Castellito. Like Hoffa, Castellito's remains have never been found. In June of 1979, both Provenzano and his co-defendant Harold Boom Boom Konigsberg's convictions were overturned, but just 1 month after that, Provenzano was sentenced to 20 years in prison for labor racketeering. The judge said that he was immune to rehabilitation.
Well, I mean, I don't think you could argue with that.
Well, true.
In May of 1980, the appellate court kicked the murder case back, but it continued to drag out. Tony Pro's brother Nuncio's legal team said that Boom Boom was a mentally ill informant for the feds and that the charges brought against him in 1981 were based on Boom Boom's testimony. But there was no proof of that, and in November of 82, the convictions of both men were upheld. Anthony Provenzano died in prison in Lompoc, California in 1988. Harold lived out his days in Florida after his release, where he passed away in November of 2014.
Harold's grandnephew wrote a book about him in 06, Blood Relations or something like that.
Interesting. Okay, let's move on to the Romano brothers, who were indicted in November of 1978 on federal charges of racketeering and tax fraud. One of the charges was that the brothers' company, KRR, had lied to the Teamsters in their loan application by stating that they had a little under $750,000 of their own to invest. But the government alleged that the money wasn't theirs, but rather their partner, Martin Kane, the K in KRR, had fronted the money. The Romanos allegedly turned around and told Kane that the loan application had been rejected. They then bought out Kane's share of the project at a significantly lower rate and took the profits for themselves and their mafia partners, Tony Pro, and their cousin, the Ribman, Tony Roma.
The Romanos each got a 25% stake in the project, and Roma received 40%. According to the investigators, quote, Roma was just a front for Provenzano, who got his local to approve the loan in the first place, end quote. They borrowed $4.7 million from the New Jersey Teamsters Pension Fund for a condominium construction project in Florida, but embezzled over $500,000 from that loan. Some of that money was invested in a restaurant in Hallandale, Florida. The following month, the Romanos sold their restaurant.
Okay, well, we'll come back to the restaurant in a bit, so let's set that aside for a minute, because this is when Alcee Hastings appears on the scene.
For our listeners who don't know who Alcee was, do you want to give him a brief bio?
Sure. Alcee Lamar Hastings was born on September 5th, 1936, to Mildred L. Merritt and Julius J.C. Hastings in Altamonte Springs, Florida. He graduated from Fisk University in Tennessee in 1958. He started law school at Howard before transferring to Florida A&M in 1960. He passed the bar in 1963 and began practicing law. He ran for the Florida Senate in 1970, but failed to secure the Democratic nomination. In 1977, he became a Broward County Circuit Court judge. He was appointed to the federal bench for the Southern District of Florida by President Jimmy Carter in August of 79, and he was confirmed by the U.S. Senate 2 months later and commissioned on November 2nd. In July of 1980, the Miami Herald reported on a federal investigation into corruption into the Laborers International Union. Named in the investigation were Santo Traficante Jr., Raymond Patriarca, the Coyas, and Albert Lepore. Patriarca was alleged to be, quote, sharing insurance company kickbacks with laborers officials in Rhode Island, unquote.
And we are not going to be covering Patriarca and the Coyas in this episode. The Romano trial began on December 3rd, 1980. Thomas Romano took the stand in his own defense on December 15th. He testified that their business partner, Martin Kane, had backed out of the deal because of the Teamsters' involvement in the project. Quote, I'm afraid for my wife and children. He said he'd rather not do business with them. I'd rather see you go it alone, end quote.
The prosecution presented 663 pieces of evidence during the trial.
Think about that number.
I know, that's insane. And the trial only lasted 20 days. On December 3rd, the brothers were found guilty on 21 counts, including fraud, racketeering, and income tax return fraud, but they were allowed to go home pending a bail hearing the following week. So they got to spend Christmas with their families, I guess. Sentencing was postponed pending court-ordered background checks on the brothers. At the next court session, Judge Hastings increased the bail bond to $100,000 each at the request of the prosecutor.
Then in February, the prosecutors increased the request to $1.2 million in forfeiture from the Romanos. Some of that money was from the sale of the restaurant in Hallandale. Supposedly, it was the largest asset forfeiture request in U.S. legal history at that point. In May, Hastings approved the forfeiture of illicit funds from the Romano brothers. Then just 1 month later, in June of 1981, Santo Traficante was indicted on racketeering charges with the LIUNA. The following month, Hastings sentenced the Romano brothers to 3 years in prison each.
So up to this point, everything seemed normal and above board. But 12 days after Hastings sentenced the Romanos, a man named William Carey Dredge walked into the U.S. Attorney's office in Miami. Dredge was an antique dealer, but more importantly, he was also in trouble with the law. A convicted thief, he had recently been arrested by the DEA for being the alleged ringleader of a drug trafficking operation that ran from Miami to Baltimore, and he was facing a lengthy prison sentence. According to Dredge, his attorney, William Borders, was corrupt. A criminal attorney, Borders had been elected president of the National Bar Association just 11 months earlier. He had also fundraised $750,000 for Jimmy Carter's failed reelection campaign. But more importantly, Borders was good friends with Judge Elsie Hastings. Dredge claimed that Borders, his own attorney, had asked him to approach Santo Trafficante in order to solicit a bribe. Dredge and Trafficante lived in the same neighborhood in Florida. Now, I don't know how these things work or how they worked in the past, but somehow the mafia guys kept showing up in Elsie Hastings' courtroom.
Okay, our listeners, please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I believe that the chief judge or justice of the circuit court used a sort of lottery system where it was a random or blind draw rotation. I'd assume that there were divisions such as criminal, civil, etc. So it was either the luck of the draw that Hastings drew those cases, or it wasn't as blind or random as it should have been.
Yeah, well, you know I don't believe that anything is random.
How stoic of you. Seneca would be so proud.
Ah, you're still pretentious, and I am not giving you a chance to slip in a snarky rebuttal there.
Relax, I'm going to be on my best behavior.
Well, the feds didn't believe that any of these characters were on their best behavior. They set up a sting operation to trap Trafficante and Borders. The plan was to monitor and observe the payoff. Borders met with Trafficante on two separate occasions, but both meetings ended in disappointment for the feds. They didn't get the evidence they needed to prosecute their case, so the G-men hatched another plan, an undercover operation. As we've mentioned in other episodes, Hoover had disapproved of his agents going undercover, but by 1980, the FBI had already conducted several, including Operation Lobster.
And here's where the story veers into our lane. Special Agent H. Paul Rico was carted out of the mothballs and chosen to go undercover because he looked most like Frank Romano from amongst the pool of aged agents.
Hey, somebody once described Rico as smarmy, so that probably helped.
I thought more swarthy, but okay.
But calling a former Fed out of retirement to pose as a mafioso is questionable at best.
Well, considering what the Boston field office had been up to by that point, inserting Rico in as an undercover op was pretty low on the sketchy scale, I think.
Well, sketchy. It appears that the Miami office also played fast and loose with the rules. But Rico was game, and in September, he signed an indemnification agreement with the FBI to go undercover as the 61-year-old Frank Romano. Rico was 5 years younger at 56 years old, but I guess it was close enough. The question of the two men's resemblance to one another came into play at Hastings' later trial, with the judge insisting there was no way that the two men could be mistaken for each other. But again, Dredge played the middleman who made the entree. The first meeting between Dredge, Rico, and Bill Borders took place on September 12th in Miami, and Rico was wired for sound. After the intro, Dredge left Rico and Borders alone. The conversation started off with the faux Frank Romano complaining about his wife's mastectomy.
Absolutely no shame. Quickly, the conversation switched to the matter at hand, bribery. Borders never actually said the magic 150K number on the wire at that time. According to Rico's later testimony, Borders wrote the amount on a piece of paper and showed it to him. During that exchange, Rico, in his role as Romano, was told by Borders that he would pass the money to Judge Hastings in exchange for probation and dismissal of the asset forfeiture for Romano/Rico. There were to be two $25,000 payments and a final $100,000 one once the deed was done.
I want to be clear that there was nothing to pin on Hastings at this point, and the Romanos had no involvement in this. It was just Dredge and Borders who were clearly up to no good. So Rico also proposed that Hastings made some kind of gesture to prove that he was a willing participant in the scheme. 4 days later, Borders reached out to Rico, slash who he thought was Romano. Dredge told Judge Hastings would be at the Fountain Blue that same evening, and Hastings appeared just as Borders had said. Another 2 days passed before Borders arrived again in Miami to meet with Rico, who was waiting for him with the first installment of the bribe money.
It all screams entrapment to me, but I'm biased. Anyhow, on the same day of the Miami meeting, Santo Trafficante was called before the federal grand jury in Tampa. He spent 15 minutes in the courtroom, but refused to speak to reporters when he left. Then on September 24th, Patriarca and the Coyas were indicted on charges of stealing more than $1 million in union insurance funds. This case was linked to the Florida charges against Trafficante.
8 days later, Borders called up Rico and told him the judge was ready to deal. Hastings would sign the order releasing the funds to the Romano brothers. According to the indictment, Borders then called Hastings. Supposedly, that conversation was recorded from Borders' phone, but the conversation was pretty vague. Later, at his own trial, Judge Hastings claimed that he and Borders were discussing another lawyer friend of theirs in Columbia, South Carolina, by the name of Hemphill Pride, who was having his own legal troubles.
Well, on October 5th, Borders told Rico that Hastings would sign the order the following day.
And he did, although the judge wrote in his decision, quote, "I neither like nor agree, but I am duty bound to follow circuit precedent." The Romano brothers' attorney, Neil Sennett, agreed with the ruling and stated that the forfeiture request by the DOJ was excessive and punitive, given that his clients had allegedly only stolen $300,000 from the union.
Now, Borders wanted the rest of the payment, so he reached out to Rico and they arranged to meet up for the final payoff. On October 9th, Judge Hastings flew to D.C. and Borders picked him up and they drove to his office. Shortly after, Borders went alone to the Marriott in Alexandria, Virginia, where he met with Rico in the garage for the final payoff. As soon as Rico handed the case of money over, the Fed swarmed in and arrested Borders.
Borders were busted, and in true Fed fashion, Rico flatly replied, "I'm afraid so."
Later, at Judge Hastings' trial, FBI agent William Murphy testified that they were afraid they would no longer have a case if Borders disappeared with the money. They had already lost the $25,000 down payment that Rico had made.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced that money went to Hastings. I think Dredge and Borders chopped it up. Borders was charged on October 9th, and Hastings stepped down a few days later, pending an investigation into the saga, and his cases were transferred to his colleagues, who were fully supportive of him. Just my gank a little note here that they likely thought that, you know, it could have been them too. They could be next.
True.
Trafficante was subpoenaed to testify at the probe into the allegations against Judge Hastings. However, as the AP noted at the time, Trafficante had pleaded the fifth and refused to testify on other occasions.
Good for Trafficante. Hastings, too, refused to appear before the grand jury in Miami that was investigating the allegations made by the FBI. He maintained that the government did not have enough evidence to convict him.
And they didn't. But, nevertheless, both Hastings and Borders were indicted on December 29th. Joseph Nestline of Washington, D.C. was also subpoenaed along with Trafficante. He was granted immunity by the judge but refused to testify and pleaded the fifth. As a result, he was imprisoned for 8 months. Upon his release, a reporter asked him if he had anything to say, and Nestline quipped, "I'll never tell." I think they really just wanted Nestline to verify Dredge's bona fides, that Dredge did indeed have access to Trafficante.
Nestline was great. I have to remember to link the video of him coming out of the courtroom and delivering that line in his classic raspy gangster voice.
Hey, it's on our social media, so if you aren't following us on Twitter or YouTube, check us out there. Anyhow, it should be of no surprise that Dredge had conveniently disappeared. The cases were severed and Borders' trial began in mid-March of 82. A U.S. district judge from Maine was chosen to preside over the trial in Atlanta. The prosecution had 17 witnesses, including H. Paul Rico, and another 25 pieces of evidence, including recordings from the wiretaps. The jury found Borders guilty, and he was later sentenced to 5 years in prison, where he served in Allenwood, Pennsylvania.
While Borders was in the cooler, Rico received a letter of commendation from FBI Director William Webster in July of 1982. Webster praised Rico for his role in the Alcee Hastings sting operation, and I know that absolutely gets your goat.
Hey, it makes my blood boil, and so does this next piece. The following month, John Callahan's body was found in his car trunk at Miami International Airport.
Another teaser for our next episode.
Yep. Okay, so Hastings' trial finally began in January of 83. Despite the defense's protests, the case was prosecuted in Miami, although the presiding judge was the same judge from Maine. Hastings was the first federal judge to be prosecuted while still actively serving. He led his own defense team and took the stand to testify on his own behalf. He threw Borders under the bus, claiming that his friend had instead, quote, traded on his name.
The Romano brothers' attorney testified on Hastings' behalf also, but Dredge was still in the wind.
Well, it did eventually find him. They moved him to Tennessee in 82, and he died there in 2012.
You have to figure the feds had to tuck him away until all was forgotten.
Well, for sure. Hastings was acquitted on February 4th, 1983. The jury took 11 votes in 17 hours, spaced out over 3 days. They went from 2 votes to convict and 10 abstentions to full acquittal. Quote, some days he seemed guilty as heck, and some days he didn't, one of the jurors commented afterward. But my favorite line was the juror who said, quote, in my opinion, the FBI botched it. Totally. When the prosecution rested, I said, that's all?
See, we weren't the only ones that thought that. Hastings returned to the bench. One of his first cases was the sentencing of Dominic Santorelli on income tax evasion charges.
See, I told you, he was still getting all the mafia cases.
Okay.
But his reprieve was short-lived. In mid-March, 2 judges filed a civil complaint against him, charging that he was indeed guilty despite his acquittal. About a month passed before the AP reported that a committee had been put together to investigate the allegations. This was the first step to an impeachment hearing before the U.S. Congress.
It would be another 3.5 years before the committee concluded in a 381-page report that Hastings should be impeached. In March of 1987, the case was sent to the Senate House Committee on Criminal Justice.
And in the meantime, both the Romano brothers had passed away. But now we have to backtrack again.
It's your freaking pastime.
You were telling a story. It's necessary.
I know. I just bust your chops. That's all.
Well, while all this was going on, Judge Hastings was still hearing and deciding cases, and the FBI's Miami office was on another case, this time targeting the ILA at the Port of Miami. As a result of a series of meetings in the summer of 85, they decided that wiretaps were in order. The presiding judge just so happened to be Alcee Hastings. He approved the wiretaps and signed a progress report a week after that. Everything seemed to be going fine until the following day when a friend of the mayor of Miami called up FBI Special Agent Tom Dowd asking about the secret investigation. He told Dowd that he had learned about it not from Alcee Hastings, but from everybody's favorite Fed, H. Paul Rico.
That incident made its way into the allegations against Hastings in the impeachment hearings in 1989. Under questioning by Senate committee, Hastings denied that he had leaked the information about the wiretaps that he had approved. In August, Borders was jailed for contempt for refusing to testify to the Senate committee despite promises of immunity.
On October 20th, 1989, Judge Hastings was found guilty on 8 of 17 impeachment articles, including conspiring with Bill Borders and lying about various aspects of the case at his trial. He was removed from the bench, but he was not barred from holding public office again. 3 years later, Hastings was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, where he remained until his death in 2022.
That must have burned more than a few of the fellow reps' butts.
Well, for sure. And for sure, we need to stop here today. Our next episode is High Lie. I am sure I will be posting High Lie videos leading up to it, so keep an eye on our social media.
And that will be next week, since we are about a week behind.
We have to try to stick to the schedule.
Well, the holidays are coming, so I'm not going to make any promises. So on that note, thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.